Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for tuning in. My name is Henrik. This is Red Ice Radio. There is a video version of this program available at redice.tv and, of course, on our YouTube channel. So do make sure that you check that out and subscribe at youtube.com/redice.tv/Radio. Well, we have something different for you, ladies and gentlemen, today. I mean, as you know, we are very interested in, you know, ancient history, in old European, Indo-European, Indo-Aryan, if you prefer, traditions and these kinds of things. And we have with us on the line today, our guest is Acharya from Dharma Central. He's the author of the Dharma Manifesto. And I wanted to bring him on to talk about some of these, you know, ancient links to the Vedic tradition, how it correlates to the European tradition or the Indo-European tradition, but also much more. We're going to talk about some of the things going on in the modern world as well. But thank you for taking the time, Acharya. It's great to have you with us.
Henrik, it is absolutely my pleasure to be on Red Ice. As I said previously, I know that you are an extremely professional interviewer. I've seen quite a few of your shows, and it is my pleasure to be on your show. Thank you for having me.
Excellent. So why don't you tell us a bit about how you ended up like studying the Vedic tradition, and what was your path like and that took you down this route, if you will?
Sure, absolutely. I would love to answer that. Before I begin, however, with your kind indulgence, I would like to first just say a very brief prayer in the ancient Indo-European language known as Sanskrit. And again, with your indulgence, this will just take a few moments. Om Bhurbhuvah Swaha Tat Savitur Varenyam Bhargo Devasya Dhimahi Dhiyo Yonah Prachodayat.
Thank you for that. That was nice. I don't know what it means, but I like it.
Oh well, I can tell you very briefly. This is the famous Gayatri mantra. Perhaps you've heard of it. It's one of the more famous mantras, and it's from the Rig Veda, which is the oldest extant writing on earth. It's at least 5,000 years old. And it is a prayer to the sun. It is a prayer in which we are praying both to the sun god, Surya, Savitur, in which we're asking for his blessings, and we are asking the sun, the light of the sun, to illumine our minds. It's also known as a metaphorical prayer to God as well, where we are asking God to illumine our minds with wisdom. So that's what that is. It's one of the most ancient prayers and mantras on earth.
I see. Interesting. Yeah, so tell us about your path.
Sure, definitely. Well, a little bit, did you want to hear a little bit more about my early upbringing first and then how I got interested in Sanatana Dharma? Or how would you like me to proceed?
Yeah, tell us what led you to, I guess, start to investigate the Vedic tradition, or what got you in that path to begin with?
Sure, okay. Well, for myself, I was born and raised in New York City in the 70s and the 80s, etc. And for myself, I'm 100% of European ancestry. My father was Italian, my mother is Spanish. Despite that fact, however, I always found myself interested in various cultures of the world. And at a very young age, I'm not sure exactly how old I was, maybe 7, 8 years old, I had a profound experience of my own mortality, where I began to question what was the meaning of life. And always having an inkling, even at a very young age, that there was much more to simply this material world, I began searching. And then finally, at the age of approximately 10 years old, I began reading the various scriptures of the world. Even at that age, I understood that, well, if I wanted to know truth, that meant I wanted to know God. And if I wanted to know God, well, where better to look for God than in all the various scriptures that purportedly speak about God? So I began reading, first beginning with the Western tradition, the Old Testament, New Testament. I went on to read the Quran at the age of 10. I didn't find it inspiring in any way whatsoever, so I quickly discarded the Quran. I went on to read various Buddhist works, the Tao Te Ching, various other works like this, a little bit of philosophy, some German idealist philosophy. But then finally, I read the Bhagavad Gita. And the Bhagavad Gita, being the most important Vedic scripture, I decided to read that as a representative of what people commonly call Hinduism, and that was the book that impressed me more than anything. When I read the Bhagavad Gita, I felt that I finally found what I was looking for, and that was truth with a capital T. That is philosophical truth, not just sectarian speculation, but rather something that was highly philosophical. And from there, I went on to begin reading other works, for example, Upanishads. I tried reading a very old translation of the Rig Veda itself, maybe when I was still around 10 or 11 years old. I then went on to read secondary sources on Vedic religion, spirituality. I then began practicing, at first on my own, practicing yoga, meditation, pranayama, various mystical pursuits like this. I then began taking yoga classes, studying with some very well-known yoga teachers at the time in the 70s, Dharma Mitra being one of them, who was still alive, very well-known person in the New York area. Swami Bua was a person I studied with very early on. Again, I must have been maybe, I'm not sure, 12 or 13 when I first met him. And he was an interesting person, Swami Bua. He was an Indian Swami living in Upper Manhattan at the time. And he taught yoga in his apartment. And again, I was 13 years old at the time. And back then, he claimed to be about, I think, 120 years old. And and he seemed it, actually. If you were to meet him, he did seem like a person who was ancient. But in any case, from there, I went on to then begin practicing Vedic spirituality in a very serious way. I, a few years after that, became a monk. I lived in ashrams. In three continents, America, Europe, and India, where I visited there twice and lived in ashrams. I was initiated in 1986 as what is called a Brahmana, that is a Vedic priest, by my guru in India. Then I came back to the West, and after living the life of a monk, and again, very orthodox celibate monk for approximately 8 years or so, then at that point, I decided to pursue my education. But that's what got me interested in Vedic spirituality, was the classic search for truth, the classic search for wanting to know what is the meaning of life.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Been there, man. that's what drove me, of course, to start the radio show. And I've always very much interested in the deeper questions. And I always have an appreciation for that. And I think that, that to a certain extent, the further back kind of into the record we go, somehow the closer we get to some kind of authenticity. I don't know. We could talk more about that later. But tell us about how were you treated as a European then when you came down to India and everything? Was that easy for you? Was that difficult?
It's interesting. It was mixed. It has been mixed. It is still a mixed experience to this day. On the one hand, Indians are extremely welcoming. However, you need to really gain their trust in order to experience that welcome. This is something that many Westerners who have approached the Vedic tradition have experienced themselves, that at first it seems as if Indians can be a little bit standoffish. The reason why, of course, is because they take their tradition very seriously, and they want to make sure that, well, if you claim that you are interested in the Vedic tradition, you're not just some drug-fueled hippie just kind of doing spiritual tourism and going to India to just kind of have out-of-this-world experience, and then you just leave. They've had too many experiences with Westerners like that, the hippie crowd. Instead, of course, what they want to do is make sure that you are indeed the real thing, that you are searching for truly authentic spirituality. As soon as they see that that's the case, you're fully embraced. And again, my experience, for the most part, has been quite good. To this day, while the vast, vast majority of my own students are not Indian, they tend to be Americans, Europeans, etc., I still work quite closely with the Indian community. I still have quite a few disciples who are, in fact, Indian Hindus. And again, it's been a mixed experience, but overall, I would say overwhelmingly positive.
What was your experience like? You were for eight years, you were a monk, and then later on, you pursued a PhD, you said. Tell us more about that.
Sure. Well, yes, I was a monk, again, several places, mostly in America, but also in the UK, for a short time in India as well. For some time, I lived at my guru's ashram in India, and that was a wonderful experience the entire time I was a monk. However, at a certain point, I realized that I had a greater mission to be engaged in the world and take the teachings that I had been studying all of that time up till that time, and to try to spread them in a much broader, much bigger, much more understandable sort of way. And I realized that the way to do this was indeed to pursue my education. You know, I had neglected my education in order to be a monk. That was a sacrifice that I made. So I decided in 1988-89 to re-pursue my education. So I went back to college. I got my bachelor's degree from Loyola University in Chicago, having majored in philosophy. I then went to the University of Wisconsin-Madison, where I got my master's degree, and then eventually my PhD. And the PhD itself was in the Department of South Asian Studies, Languages and Cultures of Asia, I believe it's called now. They changed the name of that department. But I personally focused on religious studies, and then even more so, I focused on philosophy of religion. So that's what I decided to do. And interestingly, even though I did all that work of earning all these various degrees and all sorts of academic awards, you know, the entire time I was in college for the full 10 years, I didn't pay one penny. I was fortunate enough to have academic scholarships, academic awards that paid for everything. And despite all that, to the amazement of my professors at the time, I had no desire to be a professor, which is something that they could not understand in any way. My goal was not to be a professor. I had seen too many politics in academia, and very specifically, cultural Marxist, politically correct sort of politics, where I knew I would not in any way, shape, or form fit in. So it was not my goal to be a professor. Rather, I wanted to earn the PhD so that I could then go on and teach sincere, intelligent, philosophically minded individuals about Dharma, about natural law, and to help to improve the lives of individuals, but then society in general as well. I've always been an idealist all my life. So my goal, quite bluntly, Henrik, is probably the same as your goal, and that is to save the world. It's that blunt.
Yeah, just figure out what the hell is wrong with it, right? I mean, everything is upside down, and I can't figure it out. Why is it in the state it is? And people need to start addressing it fast, or we are, you know, on a slippery slope towards bad, very bad things. That's very interesting. That's definitely something I do want to get into a little bit more later, talk about the modern world and everything else, and the West in particular, what, you know, the path that we are on right now. Let's just cover some of the aspects of the book here initially, and why you decided to write the Dharma Manifesto. Tell us what it contains and why you wanted to write it.
Sure. And it's an interesting story, actually. Yeah, this is the book here, the Dharma Manifesto. And the reason why I decided to write this book is because a book like it had never been written before. And let me explain what I mean by that. There have been certainly many political manifestos that have been written. You could say that basically today a new political manifesto comes out almost weekly. So many manifestos have been written. However, there has up to that time never been any sort of political treatise that attempts to explain what the political conclusions, the political philosophy of the ancient Vedic tradition are vis-a-vis modernity. So a book like this, again, and I know because I did the research, had never been written previous to the Dharma Manifesto. And I knew it needed to be written. And this is the reason why. Everything that's in the book, everything that's in the Dharma Manifesto, but in addition, everything that fuels my own intellectual and spiritual pursuit is predicated upon the ancient, and more, not just the ancient in and of itself, but the ancient spiritual. So all of the philosophy and political science that is contained within the Dharma Manifesto is indeed based upon the most ancient ideas that exist in world history. However, when you read the Dharma Manifesto, it's not a historical book. It's not a book about simply, oh, what did these ancients believe in the past? It is a manifesto for today, for this exact moment. This is why it has a massive policy section where I talk about precisely how we can take the ideas of the ancients and make them extremely practical. in the realms of economics and politics and social structure and governance, et cetera, et cetera. So that's the idea of the book. It is taking the most ancient wisdom imaginable, but applying it today, absolutely to our day and age. So that's why I wrote the book, because something like this had never been written. And initially, actually, interestingly, even though I had all these writings, I was somewhat wary about writing them. And it was actually the people at Arctos who asked me if they could read what I had written. And then they pretty much insisted that, yes, this needs to be a book. This needs to be a volume that people can actually read. So at that point, I gave them the writings and I left it up to them to create the book for me. And I'm very grateful to Arctos that they had the faith to put this book together, The Dharma Manifesto. And let me just say, it's been very interesting. The book itself has had an impact bigger than I thought it would have at the time. I thought it would take longer for it to have the impact that it has. But apparently the book has been read by many, many, many people throughout the world, including the people who count. And that is people who are in very high places, people who are very deeply involved in serious politics, not just political speculation on the internet, but real people who are advisors to important politicians and people like this. So I'm glad that the book was published, because it has had truly an enormous impact upon many people in the world.
Yeah, it feels or sounds a bit like, you know, the ideas that you present are not that they're incompatible, but usually when you go into, you know, ancient spirituality and things, that doesn't kind of at all correlate to what we're doing today to a certain extent, or that you can somehow apply this to, you know, to better things in our day and age. But let me just read the first, sentence here on the book on Amazon. It says, "The Dharma Manifesto is a call to action for those who seek a form of social and political action that has a firm spiritual foundation, but which also challenges the prevailing social and religious order in the postmodern West. It does not merely offer criticism, it also is a blueprint for how a national community founded upon Dharmic principles could operate in the 21st century." So tell us a bit more about that and how those old ideas can be implemented somehow in our day and age today, in the modern world.
Well, interestingly, the answer that to that question is actually, in a way, contained in the very wording of your question itself. And that is this, that these ideas aren't really old per se. In fact, they're not old at all. In fact, I would say that they are, in actuality, transhistorical. The ideas that are contained in the Dharma Manifesto are eternal. They are ideas that pertain to human beings regardless of the time frame that we're talking about. These ideas are as much true today as they were 5,000 years ago, 50,000 years ago. They will be as true 50,000 years from now. And the reason why this is the case is because they are predicated upon dharma, upon natural law, upon laws that are there inherent in the very structure of the cosmos itself. So this is basically something that is akin to science, but in the spiritual sense. These are principles that are provable, that are demonstrable, that are replicable. They are ideas that are extremely logical. And this being the case, these ideas being so philosophically powerful, of course it has to be the case that they can be translated into modern times as well. So that's the idea, basically, is to take these ancient, really eternal ideas that humanity in the highest, let's say, examples of human civilization that have existed throughout history, ideas that these civilizations have cherished, but which we today have abandoned. The idea is to reestablish these ideas.
Just exactly what is dharma then? Let's just begin at the base level of this thing. What does the word mean?
Sure. That is a very good place to start, is with the very word itself. Well, first of all, dharma, of course, is a Sanskrit word. It is a word that is not easily translated into English or any of the modern languages, actually. However, interestingly, almost all the ancient languages had equivalents for this word dharma, but again, modern languages don't. If you needed to translate it into English, you could say dharma means natural law, the natural way, the natural order. So the idea of dharma is essentially this, and I'll try to state what is actually a very deep philosophical concept. I'll try to state this as briefly as I can. As a human being, as an intelligent human being, when we look at the cosmos around us And when we look at the intricacy that we see around us, how amazing this world is, there are really only two, let's say, worldviews, only two conclusions that a person can come to, having looked at our cosmos. The first one is this. The first one is that, well, all right, this is a cosmos in which it's so vast, it's so complicated, there must be no meaning to it. It must be the case that we're just here kind of all alone and everything is simply as we observe it through our sensory apparatus and that's it. That's the first view. The second view, however, is this, that when we look at the cosmos around us, what we can see is the harmony that is there behind the seeming chaos, behind the diversity that is there. What we can see is that there is indeed an intelligence that is there behind the cosmos, behind the senses, what can be seen with the senses, and that more, there is a natural law that is there that is discernible by human beings. By human beings who have the intelligence and the wisdom to discern what those universal laws of nature are, those eternal laws of nature, and more, not merely to be able to discern those, but to then live by those laws in such a way that we as individuals, but then all of society, prospers, has health, has happiness, has meaning, etc. Well, this latter way of viewing the world, that's Dharma. Dharma gives us the sense that, yes, this world has meaning, that there is a natural law that is there. So that is essentially, in, again, the smallest nutshell, what the word Dharma means.
All right, interesting. So, I mean, usually when we think about this, we think that, you know, Dharma and the Vedic tradition kind of belongs to the East, right? That for the West to maybe even have an interest in this, or much more so maybe even Europeans, this is almost like a form of appropriation, right? That it belongs to the East, has nothing to do with the West. Address that if you can.
Sure. This has been one of my personal frustrations for a very long time, actually. The idea that the concept of Dharma is quote unquote Eastern or Indian or Asian, etc. And let me tell you, this is not the case in any way whatsoever. It is indeed true that the realm of Dharma, let's say social, politically, geographically, has receded to the point where now the majority of people who consciously align themselves with the idea of Dharma, yes, they tend to be in India, in the modern nation state of what we call India. But the truth of the matter is, understood in these very philosophical terms, the concept of Dharma is not an Eastern thing. It's not an Indian thing. On the contrary, one thing that I pointed out in both the Dharma Manifesto as well as another book of mine called Sanatana Dharma, The Eternal Natural Way, this basic concept of Dharma, of natural law, of the idea that there are natural laws that are there inherent in the very structure of the cosmos that are discernible. This is an idea that all the ancients believed. This is an idea that Plato taught, that Socrates taught, that Aristotle taught. This is an idea that all of the pre-Christian European religions of ancient times believed. In fact, this was their foundation. This was the foundation of Greco-Roman thought, of Celtic, of Slavic, of Nordic, etc. This is a concept that the ancient Persians believed. In fact, the equivalent of the word Dharma, the Sanskrit word Dharma in Persian, is Asha. This is something that the ancient Chinese believed, and the word for Dharma in ancient Chinese is Dao. Interestingly, Dao means the natural way. You find this term in Japanese in the form of Do. Etc., etc. So in all the ancient cultures, this was something that was found, this concept of Dharma. So it's very important for individuals to understand and for my readers to understand that when I use the word Dharma, I'm not using the word as something that is pertaining to quote-unquote India or the East or Asia. No, on the contrary. In ancient times, that is, let's say, pre-Abrahamic times, the concept of Dharma was embraced by the vast majority, if not the entire world, on pretty much every continent that there were human beings. So this is what we are pointing to, a truly, yes, ancient, but also eternal concept that has nothing to do with any one geographic region of today's world. We're talking about pure philosophy.
That's interesting, you know, because that might be, I've always wondered this, is there a reason why so many Europeans that seems to have lost a spiritual tradition they turn to many of these traditions, right? They turn to yoga, they turn to a kind of, obviously it's, we can address this, but a form of a new age version of the Vedic tradition of sorts. But this could be potentially then the explanation that somehow many people in the West who've ended up feeling rootless and everything else, they seek a much more ancient tradition to try to connect with it. And to a certain extent, I mean, I don't know if we are to believe in genetic memory or ancestral memory or any of those kinds of things, but maybe there's something there that resonates with Europeans, if you see what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. There is indeed something that resonates with Europeans, and that should resonate with Europeans. The reason why we have found that for at least hundreds of years, if not longer, so many Europeans have been drawn to, yes, what you mentioned, meditation, yoga, Vedic spirituality, etc., is because they were artificially severed from their own ancient cultures. You know, as we know, of course, there have been several ruptures in history, recent history, meaning for me, the last several thousand years. That's recent history for me. There have been several ruptures that have occurred in history, and as far as Europe specifically, the one could say worst of these ruptures was the introduction of Abrahamism and the Abrahamic faiths into Europe. And as a result of that, the European people's connection with their ancient ways, what today we would call paganism or pre-Christian European spirituality, culture, etc., there has been a complete disconnect between the two. And as a result of that, unfortunately, much of the knowledge has been lost. Many of the spiritual practices of Europe have been lost. And I know that, of course, there are many people, and I know a lot of them personally, who have been valiantly trying to reconstruct various forms of ancient European spirituality. But they are the very first people, including just so many of these scholars, they are the first people who will admit that, truthfully, it's something that cannot 100% be done. So much has been lost due to the burning of books, due to the killing of ancient pagan priests and the eradication of their knowledge and practices. To completely reconstruct what was there in ancient Europe spiritually is not a project that can be even close to completed in any way. So what many of these individuals have done, including, interestingly, people who are leaders of, for example, Asatru and modern Druidic sort of paganism, what they have done to fill in that knowledge gap has been to turn to Vedic spirituality. The reason being that, A, they see the connections between the two. When they examine Vedic spirituality and then they look at what ancient worshippers of Thor or ancient Druids, for example, were doing, they see them as being almost synonymous in so many ways. That's one reason. The other reason being that, yes, the Vedic spirituality is the most ancient, still existing form of spirituality on Earth. So what we find is that many, many European people and people of European descent have indeed turned to Vedic spirituality. Now, what's interesting is, you mentioned the word New Age. Some people have done this in a healthy way. Some people have done it in a very unhealthy way. And what I would consider to be an unhealthy way is precisely the New Age approach. That is essentially taking, I would say almost stealing from Vedic spirituality, mixing it up with various liberal political ideologies, a lot of speculation, a lot of feel-good sort of sentimentality, a lot of anti-philosophical sentiment, etc. This thing, this monstrosity that we call the New Age movement, many of these people have stolen from Vedic spirituality and given it a very bad name. But then, of course, you have those individuals who try to approach Vedic spirituality in a very respectful way, looking for something that is truly authentic, not rejecting who they are as European peoples, but again, using Vedic spirituality as the most ancient spirituality on Earth in order to understand themselves better. And this approach is the approach that I take. So this is why I'm very well known for this. I follow Vedic spirituality in essentially as radically orthodox, authentic, and traditionalist a manner as is humanly conceivable in our day and age, on the one hand. On the other hand, I am a European. I dress like a European. I look like a European. I speak like a European. I think like a European. Thus showing that it is not necessary in order for in order to practice Vedic spirituality, it is not necessary to abandon our own heritage. On the contrary, if we understand truly what we're doing, we understand that they are in fact a perfect marriage.
Yeah, that's very interesting. So in a way, let me know if I oversimplify the concept here, but in a way, the various European, pagan traditions is almost then maybe as a kind of a reformed denominations of the Vedic tradition?
I would say the Dharmic tradition, definitely. Just to make it a little bit more broad. Yes, all the pagan traditions of Europe follow Dharma. Again, they use different words for that. You know, if you look at every ancient European language, they had a word for Dharma. In fact, interestingly, in Lithuanian, I believe, the word that they use is Dharna, which is very similar. So similar, it's scary, actually. In ancient Latin, they used the term Liga Natura, or natural law. In ancient Greek, it was physis, meaning, again, the natural law, the natural way. And you can go on and on. Every ancient European culture had a word for this. So, again, I wouldn't necessarily call the European religions, let's say, subsects of Dharma. No, on the contrary, they were all following Dharma to the very best of their ability. I would say that these were all sister traditions, the Vedic tradition, the ancient spiritual Celtic tradition, Slavic, Asatru, etc., etc. These are all simply various, let's say, ethnic and linguistic expressions of this one worldview known as Dharma or natural law, whichever you want to call it.
So do you think that they developed maybe their own unique instances, let's say, or their own little, obviously language has transformed, and when language transformed, even thought transformed, it's been shown, so it's kind of difficult. But it seems that maybe geographical separation over time created nuances and variances. Would that be correct, do you think?
Absolutely, yes, yes. I think you stated it perfectly. That's what I would absolutely agree with. You know, this is the thing about the natural way, about natural order, is that on the one hand, we certainly believe in absolutes. There are some things, we are not relativists philosophically, ethically, etc. We believe in absolutes on the one hand, philosophically. But then on the other hand, we have always believed in a diversity of, let's say, cultural expression. Thus, this is why, if you look at the very history of Europe itself, you have the English people versus the Irish people versus the Russians, the Rus, you have, again, so many, really hundreds of various tribes, all of who are united in some ways, including especially in ancient times, by their common worldview. But at the same time, they were allowed to have distinct cultural expression in accordance with their tribal makeup. So this is actually a very logical way of bringing about a type of unity, a type of harmony with diversity within it. So this was a very logical way, a very rational way of seeing things and of having societies. So this has always been the case. This is also a part of Dharma. The idea that, yes, there are certain commonalities. The commonalities are upon the things, the points that are of importance. So again, that is philosophically, generally, spiritually. But then different peoples will have their own kinds of foods that they like. Different people will wear different kinds of clothing, will have different sorts of artistic, aesthetic expression, etc. But again, the important thing is the undergirding, underlying principle that unites all advanced peoples, and specifically the Indo-European peoples, was Dharma, was the idea of natural law. That is, that if we wish to have prosperity and happiness, we must order our societies in accordance with natural law. And then, if we do not do that, if we do not have our societies governed in accordance with natural law, we have degeneration, we have destruction. We have the destruction of civilization itself. This was the common understanding of all ancient peoples, and especially the Indo-European peoples.
Interesting. Yeah, that's very interesting. So this liberal appropriation then of this tradition must be very difficult for you to see. That, I mean, why would you say that these New Age people, they don't have a right to this tradition, because they certainly don't believe in a natural law, if you ask me. What do you think?
Mm-hmm. Oh, I agree. They don't have a right to it. That's why I've said it is precisely a type of theft. It's not something they believe in. The New Age movement, more than anything, especially in America, I assume this must be the case in Europe as well, but especially in America, the New Age movement is essentially 100% a business. It is something that exists for commercial interests alone. There is no New Age so-called leader or teacher or healer who doesn't do so as a business. You know, in fact, I've stated this, that interestingly, people who are sincere and authentic Vedic teachers, we begin nonprofit organizations. I have a nonprofit organization. New Age leaders, on the other hand, they start an LLC. They start a for-profit corporation, right. And that is almost without exception. So the reason why the New Age movement has appropriated so many elements of Vedic spirituality is not out of even close to any sincere interest in what is actually being taught in Vedic spirituality. It's to make a buck. It's because they know, intuitively, they know that there is a thirst for spirituality, and they feel that they can make some money in selling spirituality. And to me, this is the greatest travesty that could ever be perpetuated by anyone, to take the real, the true, the ancient, the eternal, and see it as just a commodity, something to just make a quick buck off of. I can't imagine anything more horrific than this.
Yeah. Yeah, it seems to go in line with, you know, the kind of commercialism that we have and the very things that has made us ruthless to begin with. That same monster, that same mechanism, that simulacrum, if you will, has also attached itself to these kinds of traditions to almost offer us a continuation of more of the same, basically, while we at the same time think that it offers something which is real and genuine, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And we've seen this in so many sectors of modern society, of course. We know that the entire media, that the entire, especially film industry, Hollywood, is predicated upon this idea that in a way, intuitively, they know what people are really searching for. What is it that people are searching for? They're searching for truth. They're searching for adventure. They're searching for meaning. They're searching for love. But rather than giving them that, yes, they give them a false image of that. They give them something that will attract them to the cinema, to Hollywood, etc. But then, of course, they take that sincere yearning on the part of their audience and they give them a demonic message. They give them a message that is actually meant to subvert those very things that they themselves are searching for as an audience. That's just Hollywood alone. We could say the same about modern government, academia, etc. Look at the universities. How many students, this breaks my heart because I was a student for so long, how many sincere, good-hearted, idealistic youth at the age of, let's say, 18, go into an academic institution, a university, a college, and they're searching for truth. They're idealistic. And milking that knowledge, these professors, many of whom are indeed demonic individuals who are either Marxists or crypto-Marxists, cultural Marxists, will take that natural idealism that they find in these youth and turn it literally completely inside out. And rather than these youth, upon graduating, being truly idealistic people and wanting to help people in a true way in accordance with natural law, on the contrary, they become enemies of natural law. They become enemies of truth. These become individuals who want to quite literally destroy the ancient. Think about this. This is one of the projects of academia, is that if it's ancient, if it's old, if it is something that smacks of the eternal or an absolute, it has to be destroyed. And so many of the minds of these innocent kids are warped in this way upon graduation.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, if we look at Islam, of course, we can see, you know, it's a very, you know, 3.0, version, if you will, of Abrahamism or the Abrahamic tradition. And it's, of course, very direct. It's very physical in its clear way that it's trying to destroy these old things, right? I mean, you mm-hmm. literally have the destruction of sites like Palmyra, and they're blowing up these Buddhist, statues and things like this in Afghanistan and Pakistan mm-hmm. and all these areas. So that's a very direct approach that people can see. But how would you say that the other branches of the Abrahamic traditions, and maybe then even in the extension, the kind of liberal modern world order that we have today to a certain extent, how are they destructive in the same way. I mean, what I'm getting at is that Islam is a very, it's clear, you can see that very clearly, but what would you say how the others also are in very much destroying it in the same way, but it's maybe more, I don't know, mental to a certain extent than Islam. It's very physical, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes. When it comes to Islam, yes, Islam basically is, yeah, very, very, very physical. But yeah, let's get to that in a second. I would like to get to the very root of what is Abrahamism, first of all, because there are many people who have heard this term, oh, the Abrahamic religions, and generally they understand that the Abrahamic religions means Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. But they don't quite understand what is the metaphysical significance of Abrahamism. So with your indulgence, if you don't mind, I just want to talk about this a little bit, because almost no one has previous to my writing about this in the Dharma Manifesto. And if we're going to understand Abrahamism, we have to understand what are the metaphysical underpinnings of this worldview, for lack of a better term. The metaphysical underpinnings itself goes back to the very name, Abraham. 4,000 years ago, roughly, more or less, there was an individual who came upon the scene whose name was Abraham, and he brought about one of the first of these, what I call, ruptures in history, where the entire ancient world had been going in one direction, but now Abraham comes upon the scene, and suddenly the world is going in a radically different direction. But the question is why? And again, there are metaphysical reasons for why this is the case. Abraham, as we know, for those individuals who are conversant with the Old Testament and his story, and I'm going to make this very brief, when he traveled from Mesopotamia, which originally was indeed a Vedic city, a Dharmic city, when he himself traveled to the Levant, to what today we would call Palestine or Israel, something very interesting happened. He encountered a being in the desert, and this being, individuals who follow Dharma would consider to be what we call technically in Sanskrit an asuric being. This was a demonic metaphysical entity that has many different names, El or Yahweh. Later in Islam, this being came to be known as Allah. It's the same being. But when Abraham encountered this being, again, to make this very brief, this being made a covenant with him. This being made essentially a business deal. One of the first demonic business deals in history with Abraham, where essentially he promised Abraham worldly wealth. Essentially, he said, all of this land will be yours, you will prosper, your sons will prosper, and for generations to come, the world will be yours if you do one thing, and that is worship me. Well, followers of Dharma consider this, again, to have been a demonic being. And what was introduced at that time was several things that did not exist in history. First of all was the idea of, to state it theologically, anthropomorphic monotheism. That is the idea of the divine being a very petty god. So what do we find? We find for the first time in history the concept of religious war. Now, interestingly, previous to Abraham, there was no religious war. There were wars between religious people, but the idea of, oh, we have our religion and we're going to conquer your people with the idea that our God wants you to convert to our religion, and if you don't, we will kill you. That did not exist previous to Abrahamism. So what we find throughout the Old Testament is indeed the bloody history of the Old Testament, of the ancient Hebrew people going from place to place throughout the Levant and quite literally slaughtering people and taking over. Well, we find the same mindset in early Christianity. And with Christianity, I have to make a very important distinction because Christianity is a very interesting thing. Personally, I find a lot of inspiration in the person of Jesus, in his teachings, in his life actions, etc., his personality, his characteristics. I consider Jesus to be someone himself who actually rebelled against Abrahamism. If you read the New Testament, which I have many times, I've actually studied the New Testament under some of the world's best theologians and theological professors. If you read the New Testament, it's obvious he was rejecting Abrahamism. He was rejecting the Jewish religion. He was rejecting the worship of Yahweh. And in fact, at no time in the New Testament does he refer to the God who he worships in these Old Testament terms. Rather, the only term that he uses is Abba, or Father. So I consider Jesus himself to have been someone who rebelled against Abrahamism. His reward was, of course, that he was killed, he was crucified. And soon after, his movement started to veer toward Abrahamism again, especially under Paul. That's why I make the distinction between Paleo-Christianity versus Pauline Christianity. So when it comes to Christianity, it's kind of a mixed bag. It's mostly Abrahamist, but its root core is not. The teachings of Jesus are dharmic. So this is why, for example, you have such phenomena within Christianity as the ancient mystics, the Gnostics. You have individuals like St. Francis, who you look at these people, these are obviously not Abrahamists. But at the same time, the mainstream churches always saw these people with suspicion. So again, Christianity has been a tradition that has been schizophrenic, that has actually had two trends within it. The main core has been Abrahamic, but then you have that mystical realm that is non-Abrahamic. But now when it comes to Islam, yes, Islam is one of the tail ends. I wouldn't call it the tail end of the Abrahamic tradition, but it is one of those. And what Islam is, what I have termed it, has been Old Testament religion on steroids. It is the idea of world conquest through the sword, the idea that, yes, it goes back to a very fundamentalist sort of Abrahamism, where essentially you convert to the worship of our God, this Yahweh, who in Islam they call Allah, but is the same being, or you die. That blunt, that simple, that black and white. So what we find in Islam is indeed the tail end of, let's say, the devolution of Abrahamism, and seen in very stark form. But yes, again, all three of these traditions, Judaism, let's say mainstream Christianity, and Islam, all of Islam, I include Shia among this as well, and Sufi among this as well. These are all Abrahamist, and they are in every way the literal opposite of every other ancient religion on earth, what I call the Dharmic. So essentially, just to sum this up quickly, you have the Abrahamic religions on the one hand. On the other hand, you have the Dharmic religions. And when I say Dharmic, I mean not just Vedic, not just Vedic and Buddhist, not just Vedic and Buddhist and Jaina. I mean also the ancient European religions. I mean all of the nature-based natural religions of the world. You have all of those on the one hand versus the Abrahamic. And the history of the last 4,000 years has been essentially a 4,000 year war between Abrahamism versus the natural way. And obviously for the last 4,000 years, sadly, Abrahamism has been winning dramatically. That is about to turn around, however, but we can talk about that whenever you wish.
Yeah, definitely. That's very, very interesting. You know, I want to hear more about this. I want to put this in context to, you know, the what we're facing now in modernity. There's so many things happening, from, of course, the spiritual crisis that we're going through to the, you know, refugee crisis and all these kinds of things that are happening now at this point. It's a global upheaval, basically, and you have, you know, wars on top of that. So there's much to discuss here, and I definitely want to go into detail in this in the second segment. But before we do that, let's just plug the websites a little bit, Ashori. And I want, of course, you again to mention to people, the viewing audience and the listeners, how they can get a copy of the Dharma Manifesto. Where's the best place to go? So please go ahead and tell us about that.
Sure, definitely. Well, thank you for that opportunity. Our main website, and we have many websites, actually, but our main website is dharmacentral.com. And Dharma Central is a purely spiritual website. You can find most of my books on there. So yes, that's definitely our main website. In addition to that, we have another website that is called dharmanation.org. And that is more of a political website, and that website is especially tied to the Dharma Manifesto. The Dharma Manifesto is available everywhere. The publisher is Arctos, which is a wonderful publisher. I've been extremely happy with them. They've been great to work with. So certainly you can get it on their website, but it's also available on Amazon, on barnesandnoble.com. Essentially, if you Google the Dharma Manifesto, you'll find one way or another to find it and buy it.
if you would share something, one last thing here in the first segment of, let's say, people who are maybe, for, you know, tuning into the show, they're concerned about, you know, the state of Europe, of the European man, the Western world right now. We're under attack in so many different ways. Tell us about why you think they would find your book interesting, if you can.
Sure. Well, for several reasons. First of all, it explains the very root causes for why Europe has been, for the last roughly 2 years, 3 years, experiencing the tremendous crisis that it has been. But more, it gives very, very specific policy solutions for how to eradicate these problems. Not just philosophically, but again, very, very specific. One thing that I'm very happy with the Dharma Manifesto is that essentially the first part lays out the philosophy of how we got to where we are today. But the second part is purely policy. It explains essentially every sort of issue of governance, of social policy, political policy, economic policy, etc., that a fully functioning natural law that is dharmic state, what I call a dharma nation, should be practicing in order to successfully solve all of these problems. Yeah, the book itself, people have to understand, is highly philosophical, but it's extremely practical. It gives very blunt solutions that A, B, and C must be done if we are to solve, for example, the immigration problem, if we're going to solve the problem of the degeneracy of culture in general, if we're going to solve the problem of the breakdown of the marriage, et cetera, et cetera. You can go on with the entire list of crises that we're experiencing right now. The Dharma Manifesto mentions all of the most important of these and gives very unambiguous answers as far as what to do to solve these problems. So if anyone is watching this who cares about the future of Europe, the future of America, and wants to see sanity restored to these nations, and especially along the lines of natural law, this book gives you the answers for how to do that.
All right, well, we'll talk more about that in the second segment as well as we continue. So definitely stay tuned, ladies and gentlemen. We're going to continue with the Sharia after the break. In the meantime, you have the websites, you know where to go. And of course, if you are on our site, you'll have the links right there as well. So definitely click through from our site. But yeah, we'll take a short break, folks. We'll be right back. More with the Sharia after this. Well, ladies and gentlemen, if you like the first hour, please sign up to tune in, listen, or watch the second segment, the second hour at redeyesmembers.com. With a membership, you get full access to everything that we have done. Going back to our start in 2006, you can tune into our live show most weekends. You also have access to all our inside episodes, films, videos, and basically everything else that we do here at Red Eyes. So definitely support alt-right media. Sign up at redeyesmembers.com. It does help us tremendously with your support, and we can grow. We can bring on more people, more reporters. We can cover more and we can ultimately bring you more truth and a sharper spear in the fight against globalism. So definitely do support us. RedIceMembers.com. This Sunday, we'll be doing another live TV show, Weekend Warrior. Don't miss it. Call in, join us in the chat. On Saturday, we'll be doing some coverage of the Patriot rally in Berkeley. We're not going to do that live. We have reporters on site that's going to be gathering material for us. So probably towards the end of Saturday evening, we'll have something for you up on redeyes.tv. So heads up on that. We'll see you on the other side of the break. Thank you so much for listening or watching.